Hello, I'm Andy Burnham, and you're listening to Sparks on Radio Facts. This week, Toshiba pull out of making audio equipment. We examine why. Problems with radon gas. What is it and how to get rid of it? 25 years of ITN. A new design of two-stroke engine for cars. The latest line of loony loudspeakers. The success of arts graduates who join BBC Engineering for technical training. More Radio Caroline news, and lots more, whatever we can fit into the time. With your letters, it's Sparks from Radio Facts, 3910 6205 and 12255. up soon on the 16th of August, to be exact, is a radio rally in Southend, organised by the Southend and District Radio Society. It's at the Rochway Centre in Rochford in Essex. And you can have a table for £10 or £5 outside. And booking is John Stone on Southend 0702 202216. That's the Southend Rally at the Rochway Centre in Rochford in Essex, the 16th of August this year. For more information, 0702 202216. And I'm hoping to take the Sparks stand down there, so I'll see you there.
Radon is a naturally occurring radioactive gas. Everyone is exposed to it. Radon is present in the air. You can't see, smell, or taste radon, but for most of us, radon accounts for about half of all the radiation we are exposed to. Like any other cancer-causing substance, it's thought that there's no completely safe level of radon. Radon is formed from uranium, a radioactive element found in rocks and soil. As uranium spontaneously changes or decays, it produces radon gas. Radon itself decays, releasing packets of energy or radiation. Radon formed in the ground diffuses through to the surface and disperses in the air, so levels outside, measured in becquerels, are very low. But radon becomes a problem if it is drawn into buildings where, if it is unable to disperse, it can accumulate to harmful levels. Indoors, the decaying radon attaches itself to dust specks and fine moisture droplets in the air. When you breathe in, these particles, now radioactive, are drawn into the lungs, where surrounding body tissues are irradiated. This irradiation increases the risk of cancer. There's a small possibility, just about anywhere across the country, that your house might have high levels of radon. But the chance is much greater in some parts of the country than others. Houses don't have fixed radon levels. They can vary from hour to hour and from day to day. Heating and ventilation, weather conditions, the amount of radon in the ground, and how easy it is for the gas to reach the surface all affect levels. Devices that give an instant reading of radon concentration won't tell you about the average level you're living with, though they may help by identifying how radon is getting into the house. Other tests can be carried out over a few days or a week. High readings may indicate that there is a problem worth investigating, but a low reading is no guarantee you don't have a problem. Only measurements made over several months will give a reliable estimate of the average radon level in your house. The National Radiological Protection Board, government advisers on radiation protection, recommend measurements over a three-month period. To get a test done, write to the NRPB and request a free radon measurement. Free tests are available for all householders unless you live in a very low-risk area. NRPB will send you two detectors, one for your main living room and one for the main bedroom. After 3 months, you return the detectors. The NRPB will write back about a month later with your reading and advice about whether you need to take action. Well, there's a map here showing the percentage probability of a house exceeding the action level. In red, at greater than 3%, Devon and Cornwall. Next, between 1% and 3%, Derbyshire, Northamptonshire and Somerset. 0.3 to 1%, Clwyd, Dumfries and Galloway, Dyfed, Gloucestershire, Grampian, Gwynedd, Highland, Isle of Man, Powys and Shropshire. 0.1% to 0.3%, Avon, Borders, Cumbria, Durham, Gwent, Lincolnshire, Mid Glamorgan, Northumberland, Nottinghamshire, Oxfordshire, South Glamorgan, South Yorkshire, Tyne and Wear, West Glamorgan, West Sussex and West Yorkshire, and lowest risk of all, everywhere else, less than 0.1%, which on the map is East Anglia, southeast of England, most of southern England, and the central lowlands of Scotland and Ulster. There are three main remedial methods for reducing the amount of radon in your house. Sumps, improved ventilation under the floor, and positive pressurisation. Sealing up any holes or cracks in the floor and walls could also work, but in practice it is very difficult to do. The pressure inside a house is usually slightly lower than in the ground below. This pressure difference sucks radon-laden air into the house. A sump, simply a small hole a foot or two across and a foot or so deep, is dug through the solid floor or under the house through an outside wall. A pipe is connected to the sump with the outlet sited outside, usually above the roof. A fan fitted to the end of the pipe sucks air from the sump beneath the floor, reducing the pressure difference between the house and the ground, and so reducing the amount of radon being drawn in. In addition, the fan extracts radon from beneath the floor and expels it outside. This technique can reduce radon levels by large amounts, often the only solution for houses with very high radon levels. It's not usually suitable for suspended floors, which have a void beneath them, and it needs a fan running continuously, which costs £40 to £50 a year and may cause a slight noise. And also, the pipework can be unsightly or disruptive to install. Another technique is improving the ventilation in the space below a suspended floor. Radon can be swept outside before it has chance to enter through the floor. This can be done by clearing existing air bricks or by fitting more. To reduce radon further, a fan can be fitted in one of the air bricks to improve air flow. It's cheap and often easy to do, with very little disruption to the house. If a fan is needed, it will have the same disadvantages for fans with sumps. And by blowing air into the house, the pressure difference between the inside of the house and beneath the floor could be reduced. This technique reduces the amount of radon-laden air leaking in. Also, the improved ventilation dilutes the indoor radon concentration. There's little disruption. The fan is installed, usually in the loft, and blows air into the house. Improved ventilation may make the air fresher and cut down condensation. The drawbacks are that it's not suitable for older properties with various cracks and gaps. There's a £40 or £50 a year running cost, or more if there's a heater included, and heating bills generally are likely to increase if the fan is blowing cold air into the house. All those details about radon and what to do about it in Which, the magazine of the Consumers Association.
And in the Financial Times, Toshiba pulls the plug on the audio equipment business. Stefan Wagstall examines the challenge the Japanese group is facing as a new president takes over. Toshiba, the Japanese electronics combine, has discreetly pulled out of making radio cassettes, compact disc players and other kinds of audio equipment. No factories have been closed or jobs cut. The operations have been quietly subsumed into the group's television and video products business. Nevertheless, a famous name has disappeared from hi-fi stores the world over. Toshiba's move out of audio is a sign of the way in which even the largest Japanese groups are being forced to respond to a worldwide recession in the electronics industry and a sharp increase in the cost of capital. Moreover, Toshiba, which operates in information processing and power engineering, as well as consumer electronics, has been hit particularly hard by the rapid onset of technological change in the computer and semiconductor industries. In the late 1980s, it reaped bumper profits from pioneering new ranges of memory chips and portable computers. Today it's under pressure in both markets. Toshiba still prides itself in a wide product range, high research and development spending, and its technological prowess. But these boasts are hedged by a newfound concern for husbanding resources, particularly capital. Our basic philosophy is to meet the needs of the people, says Mr. Fumio Sato, who takes over as president. However, before we used to make anything that would sell, now we consider quality. That means, among other things, our profit margins. Mr. Sato believes Toshiba's future rests firmly in semiconductor and computer manufacturing, which account for about half the group's sales. However, he acknowledges the group's face severe problems. In semiconductor manufacture, Toshiba, like other Japanese makers, is losing money, since prices for memory chips have plunged due to weak demand and intense competition. This is in sharp contrast to the late 1980s, when Toshiba stole a march on the rest of the industry by pioneering mass production of 1 megabit dynamic RAM memory chips, a top-selling product, and reaped profits from being the first into the market. However, the race to produce the next generation memory device, the 4 megabit dynamic RAM, resulted in no clear winner and wafer-thin margins. Similarly, in computers, Toshiba beat other manufacturers in bringing to market in the late 1980s a mid-priced portable laptop machine, equipped with many advanced features. But other manufacturers have since followed Toshiba's lead, driving down prices and paring margins to the bone. Laptop machines, a luxury 5 years ago, have become a commodity. Mr. Sato says Toshiba is planning to launch a new range of laptops later this year, but declines to give details. Mr. Sato believes that to stay abreast of technological change, Toshiba must seek partners, as well as continuing to invest heavily in its own R&D. Yesterday, the group announced a venture with Apple, the US computer maker, for the joint development of multimedia products, which combine computing, television, and audio technology. It already has a joint venture with IBM, the world's largest computer company, for making color liquid crystal displays for computers. It's considering a second agreement with IBM for the joint production and development of flash memories, a new generation of microchip which could replace the hard disk memory. That report in Financial Times. And some letters now. Let's grab the folder and see what we find. Yes, a postcard made up of a photo, a new service from the post office that I haven't seen. You can send your photo and get it made into a postcard. This one is of a cat in a garden and a flower pot with some plants in. Just a note to let you know I'm still enjoying your programmes. In particular, I love the ethnic music, Bulgarian and African, you've been including in Sparks. I have several LPs of these myself. I even enjoy the country programme, even though it's not my cup of tea. How's about some 70s pretentious crap, e.g. ELO? ELP, Emerson, Lake and Palmer. Lots of initials here, I'll have to work out what they mean and play you some. PFM, YBO. Who do they... Oh, yes! There's still a few of us who still admit to liking it. Yes, I've got some of their albums tucked away. Right, I'll go and dig some out. I've just started playing with packet radio, which is great fun. Although I gather that the Radio Communications Agency won't allow pirate radio bulletins. However, there's plenty of other amusing messages going around the network. Good luck to you all! Thanks, Mark, who is G0... O1W and GB7VMR, who is in... Where does he live? Hasn't got an address on it. Okay, another letter now is from Woolerton in Nottingham. Huge letter from Darren Witt, who says, I've at long last got round to putting pen to paper, although in this case fingers to keyboard. I've been listening to Radio Facts ever since you started broadcasting again last April. I actually found you on the 20th of April 1991 when you were playing non-stop music, including Kylie Minogue. Yeah, I had to go round in the car with Trevor enduring that when we were setting it up. I think we'll have to get a new test tape next time. Since then, I've listened virtually every day on my JVC W150 radio cassette system on 6205. Unfortunately, it only goes down to just under 6 MHz, so I'm unable to listen to you on 3910 during the night. Having said that, ever since mid-March, 6205 sometimes can be heard quite clearly during the night. The aerial I use varies from its built-in antenna to a bit of speaker wire wrapped around the antenna, which then leads up the top of my wardrobe with the remainder dangling down the other side. Sounds naff, but it does the job. When there's good propagation, 6205 comes really clearly. Dare I say it, I think the actual sound quality of 6205 is quite good, with high modulation and a nice amount of bass, as well as treble, which makes music and speech sound quite good, considering all this is on shortwave. Sparks is definitely the best speech-type program I have ever heard, with plenty of interesting articles. I tend to find that such articles are much more interesting when you hear someone else reading them, rather than yourself, and by playing the odd record makes the program even more listenable. I must say that I totally agree with you regarding the comments to ILR. It all sounds the same, with very bland and unexciting programming. The state of British radio is extremely depressing. Until Radiofax came on the air, there was nothing to listen to except perhaps Radio Luxembourg, but even that's finished on 208. And I'm not buying a satellite system which can only be used in the house. Being a real Caroline fan, it was great to hear their satellite programmes on Radiofax, although hopefully we'll eventually be able to listen to them once again live from the North Sea. I've been a keen listener to her for a long while and followed her very closely, especially over the last few years, and I've got quite a few recordings, the last being on the 21st of October 1990, when Radio Caroline was on 819, albeit short-lived after the Spectrum fiasco. The archive programmes are also really good, and I've recorded virtually all of them, not to mention the Caroline programmes, of which I've also recorded virtually every one. On one of the archive programmes, you played an extract of Radio 558-819 and stated something along the lines that the station moved to 819 due to the low-powered signal on 819. I think this is possibly incorrect, although do excuse me if I am. I think the way I understood the story to be was that initially the station was on the air for just over a day via a fiberglass mast which caught fire the next day. Having no other means of transmitting the station, they were forced to use 558 during the day until a diplexer could be built so that the existing aerial array could be used to transmit two frequencies, and eventually Radio 819 did begin transmitting on 819 kHz in early November 1988. I think the best less said about the fiberglass mast, the better, really. It was sent from Canada as some sort of good idea at the time by the Canadian people and had no chance of working ever, really. However, even then the transmitter power was probably not more than 2 kilowatts, which is pretty low, bearing in mind the service was aimed at the Netherlands. You also mentioned the way the Dutch station was airing news read in English. Well, when I was listening to it, there were only two news bulletins in English a day, and this was the so-called international news. It was only really useful when the station was on 558 during the day, when Caroline listeners were tuned to 558 during the daytime. The Pirates scene here in Nottingham has been quite active recently. When I came home from university in mid-June, there were three stations broadcasting, which were Horizon on 100 MHz, Heatwave 100.5, they've been there for years, Globe FM 101 MHz, yes, I've heard all them when I was up seeing some friends. However, with the imminent start of Classic FM all around this frequency area, they announced they would be changing frequency, and sure enough, the day before Classic FM started testing on 100.1, Horizon moved to 97.5 and Globe FM to 105.3. Globe actually transmitted simulcast on both 101 and 105.3 for about 5 hours, asking their listeners to change frequency. Heatwave remained on 100.5 for about a week until they disappeared altogether. Then Horizon disappeared, and I have not been heard of since, probably raided, which appeared to prompt Globe to leave the air, as they didn't come back until about 2 weeks later when they returned on 107.7. I don't think they were raided, but being very careful, as they seemed to be transmitting very little during the week. When they were on 101, they were transmitting 20 hours a day, 7 days a week. During this period, a new station has started, 107.3, called Touch FM, which is to me is a revamped Rave FM, but with no live DJs, just recorded spoken jingles. As I write in mid-July, three stations are more or less on the air. Heatwave 107, Touch FM 107.3 in stereo, and Globe FM on 107.8. Up in the 107s, this is quite unusual for pirate radio. Is there anywhere else in the country where there's so much activity right up the top end of the band? Write in and let me know. Back to the letter now from Darren. Anyway, enough about this and a little about myself. I'm 20 years old and currently studying a degree in information technology at the University of Teesside. It's one of the new generation universities, being once a polytechnic but now full university status. I'm about to go to Brussels in Belgium to work for IBM at their International Education Centre for my industrial placement year as part of the course. Because of my interest in the field of computers, Sparks makes fascinating listening and enables me to keep in touch with the for changing technical developments. Judging by all the reception reports you've received, I should have little problem receiving Radio Facts over in Belgium. The other programmes you broadcast make good listening. However, I'm not too keen on World of Country. Saying that, however, it's better than any country-type programme I've heard on ILR. That's about it for the moment. I wish you luck in obtaining a licence. You'll need it from the DTI we've got. It almost makes you laugh when you have read some of the pathetic responses you've received from them. I wonder what you would do if you were put in charge of the DTI. It would be interesting, wouldn't it? It doesn't bear thinking about, frankly. Anyway, many thanks for your hard work in making what I consider Radio Facts a great and, most importantly, interesting station currently on the dial. And he signs off with LA, loving awareness. Thanks very much, Darren Witt, whose home address is in Woolerton in Nottingham, but also jets about from Teesside and is going to Belgium next year. Thanks very much for that letter. You're listening to Sparks on Radio Facts, 3910 6205 and 12255. Every week, the programme of science, technology and media news. And here's some yes for Mark, who sent us the nice postcard of his cat.
25 years of news at 10, described in cooling down in a hot seat. The recent 25th anniversary of the first broadcast of ITN's News at 10 also marked the retirement of Britain's longest-serving newsreader, Andrew Gardner, who, together with Alistair Burnett, introduced Britain to the half-hour news bulletin format with the first News at 10 on July the 3rd, 1967. Gardner recalls, most of the ITV companies were so opposed to this new half-hour bulletin that they would only put it into the schedule for 13 weeks. They said people would be bored stiff after 10 minutes of news. It was also a blazing hot day, and we were stuck in a tiny attic room in Kingsway, now part of the Office of Population Censuses and Surveys, under those very hot, old-fashioned tungsten lights, with our socks off and our feet in buckets of dry ice to cool us down. The first night was not a hot news day. For the second night, ITN's editor, Geoffrey Cox, risked the then very large sum of several thousand pounds to get pictures from San Francisco via landline and satellite of ballet stars Margot Fonteyn and Rudolf Nureyev behind bars, having been wrongly arrested on drugs charges. Gardner, who had a 10-year News at 10 partnership with the late Reginald Brosenkay, is retiring after 31 years as a newscaster. He dislikes the terms presenter and newsreader as too passive. He started with ITN as a reporter in 1961, after 4 years freelancing for BBC Radio in Africa and BBC Television in Britain. For the past 15 years, he has been anchoring Thames News, Thames Television's nightly regional bulletin, for London and the South East, as well as remaining the voice of ITV for big national events, commenting on or fronting general elections, telethons, and two royal weddings. But he has a bleak view of the future of television news and current affairs. I think we're in danger of becoming the NAF 90s. The currency of the newscaster has been gradually eroded and become devalued. Gardner is also critical of the way news has developed. It's not for me to suggest how ITN changes, but I think that News at 10 is now a programme in search of a new identity. When we started, we were the only half-hour news bulletin, and that nightly programme was the flagship. Nowadays, on all channels, news organisations are much bigger. Journalists service many outlets, and I think there is a general blandness to all the bulletins. Today, as I watch the headlines on any channel, too much is predictable. The adventure and the excitement seem to have evaporated. Now the public is saturated with television news and expects daily miracles. With modern technology, where can you go in the world that isn't immediately covered? 25 years ago, television news was revolutionary. It was news in itself how news was covered. With Thames, he went through the trauma of the ITV franchise auction, in which the company lost its right to broadcast. I believe the viewers will be the long-term sufferers, he says. I was deeply shocked to hear one of the new boys from Carlton, which will take over Thames's franchise, announcing quite openly that serious and highly successful news and current affairs programmes like This Week will be marginalised if they do not attain top ratings, which they never can. So where does the marginalising stop? Are we going to have wall-to-wall bland crap? And are we going to marginalise important programmes like News at 10? I think ITV's biggest battle in the next 12 months is going to be to prevent the less responsible new broadcasters from marginalising serious news simply because it is labour-intensive and therefore expensive. His plans for the future include corporate videos, one of his sons is a corporate video director, and possibly advertisements. He is writing 3 books, one autobiographical about his own television career, one historical, and one fictional. He'll be missed by some in the industry. He is an extremely professional broadcaster, says David Nicholas, editor of News at 10 for 12 years and chairman of ITN until his retirement last year. He has a magnificent voice, full of authority, and he's a marvellous man to have on your side in a crisis. Andy Allen, now Managing Director of Central Broadcasting, who as editor of Thames at 6, brought Gardner from ITN to Thames Television, is equally unreserved in his praise. He never, never had an overinflated view of his own importance, which is unusual among newsreaders. They can get a bit carried away sometimes and think they are as important as the news they are reading. Andrew has never done that. Roz Morris reporting on 25 years of ITN and the retirement of Andrew Gardner in Media Guardian.
I hope you're not getting sick of hearing about digital compact cassette, but 6 consumer companies have ordered digital compact cassette components from Philips, and at least 4 other firms are gearing up for DCC hardware production, according to the head of Philips Consumer Electronics Key Modules Group, Jan Oosterweld. The news is further evidence of DCC's lead over Sony's minidisc in the battle to replace the analog compact cassette, at least according to Philips. They're selling a complete DCC component package, including the chipset, thin film head and all other non-standard parts needed to make DCC machines. Oosterweld said Philips expects to make more than 20% of its entire hardware profits from DCC through component sales. Well, if they make their money that way, they just go into DCC players. They don't have to actually sell them to anyone, so even if the thing's a flop, they're going to make some money out of selling the components to other poor hardware manufacturers. And at the moment, the 9-chip DCC chipset is listed at £30, but Oosterweld stressed that this price will fall rapidly as production ramps up. Philips has designed a new top-secret fixed record playback head for in-car DCC players, due to be launched next year, to avoid problems caused by jolting encountered in the standard head, which rotates to switch between digital and analog playback. Some other short items of news. Japanese firm JVC said last week there will be more than 500 titles available on DCC tapes in Japan by the end of the year. However, more than 80% of them will be in Japanese, with Japanese music. Can't wait for that. Pioneer has launched the world's first rewritable PAL video disc recorder, with a novel dual head design that allows continuous playback from different parts of the disc, and simultaneous erasing and recording. The recorder uses magneto-optical technology similar to that developed for Sony's minidisc recordable audio disc system. Each disc holds 48,000 video frames, representing 32 minutes playback time. The pictures are stored on the disc in time-compressed analog component format. Pioneer claims the 30-centimeter optical disc can handle more than 1 million over-recordings, unlike professional videotape, which has to be replaced after only a few recordings. The disc has an access time of around 0.3 seconds, but during a pre-programmed playback sequence there is no search delay because one head can find the next disc segment while the other is still playing back. And back to Philips again and their battle against Sony. A recordable CD player aimed at the consumer market is likely to be launched next year, priced at around £800 by Philips. It's believed they're timing the launch so as to scupper Sony's proprietary recordable disc system minidisc, due to hit the market in December. Philips hopes this will make the way clear for its digital tape technology, DCC, to take over the mantle of analog audio cassettes, by far the most successful music carriers today. The consumer recordable CD is based on the same write-once technology used in professional CDR machines, which cost upwards of £3,000. A disc has a special dye layer which turns dark when struck by a laser beam of sufficient energy. Philips believe a recordable CD player launched soon after minidisc will throw a spanner in the works for Sony. A Sony spokesman said consumers would not tolerate a system that could only record once, leaving no room for error. So the battle goes on and we'll be following it as it gets into actual volume sales around Christmas time.
Power to power plant. Commence battle stations procedure.
Battle stations, battle stations, battle stations. PWOR.
Well, what are you waiting for? You're right. What am I waiting for?
Battle stations.
by for launch, Commander.
Okay, sound launch station.
Yes, sir.
This is a full-scale emergency. Have all units on standby.
Isn't it risky? We've never tried it.
But you, die.
That ruined their little plan. Yep.
Marineville calling Stingray. Marineville calling Stingray.
Stingray.
Wow. What a beauty.
Music, we can have it.
On you.
Right.
That's what I call cool. Real cool.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Philips DC-777 car radio is a must for all serious shortwave listeners who spend time in the car. The Philips DC-777 packs a sophisticated shortwave tuner, AM-FM tuner, and cassette player and powerful stereo amplifier into a standard-size car radio unit. AM, FM, and shortwave coverage from 3170 to 21910 continuous. The stereo cassette deck is also auto-reverse. Check out the review in the World Radio and TV Handbook, and it received 4 stars in the Radio Netherlands receiver shopping list. This top-of-the-range Philips car combination is available to Radiofax listeners at the special price of £249. Contact the Radiofax sales office by telephone in the UK on 0483 275 997 or write for the brochure at Radiofax, The Forge, Cranley, GU6 7BG in England.
It is electric, light, and shockingly close to production. Mention a 2-stroke engine and thoughts focus on lawnmowers. Hardly the kind of power unit to provide lively propulsion for a car, you might think. You would be wrong. As the lawnmowers burbled in Suffolk Gardens last week, I zipped past in what looked like an ordinary Ford Fiesta, but concealed under its bonnet was a prototype 2-stroke engine. Far from inviting any jibes about a mower-like pace, it displayed a level of performance which was brisk and punchy. It had a responsiveness which was energising behind the wheel and beautifully flexible power. Its only drawback seemed to be the accompanying assault on the ears. The noise from the engine was more irksome than actually loud, buzzing away like an angry sewing machine gone mad. But that may well be curable before the engine eventually goes into volume production, as Ford plans, before the end of the decade. At its Dagenham factory in Essex, Ford has just built 25 Fiestas powered with the two-stroke, three-cylinder, 1200cc catalyst-equipped engine, which is jointly developed with the Orbital Engine Company of Australia. Before the end of the year, another 35 such cars are scheduled for production. All will undergo extensive trials over the next 2 years with high-mileage fleet operators, including the police. And by the late 1990s, you could be driving one. One of the advantages of the Orbital engine is its cleanliness and fuel efficiency. Catalytic equipped and using unleaded petrol, it is able to meet the world's toughest exhaust emission standards. The engine is 10% more powerful and 12% better on fuel economy than an equivalent capacity four-stroke engine. Its flexibility and smoothness is claimed to match the standards of a four-stroke six-cylinder. My brief driving appraisal on East Anglian roads endorsed that view. Compared with a four-stroke, the engine block is tiny and very compact, 100mm less in height and 70mm narrower. It is also lighter, saving about 30 kilos, or around one-third the weight of an equivalent four-stroke. Its size means it needs much less under-bonnet space, promising greater diversity in future car styling. There are other advantages to a two-stroke. It is less complex engine, with no valves, no oil filter, and less to go wrong. Running costs are much lower, because there is so little that needs servicing attention. Only the spark plugs and air cleaner need periodic changing. Two-stroke is a British invention, but by no means a new one. The first two-stroke was developed by a Scot, Glasgow engineer Sir Dugald Clark, in 1880, 4 years after Dr. Nicholas Otto developed the first four-stroke engine, but 3 years before Gottlieb Daimler succeeded in running a four-stroke petrol engine to propel a motor vehicle. The key difference between two- and four-stroke engines is the number of combustion cycles per revolution. A two-stroke has double the firing pulses. It is not only in small Fords that two-strokes are destined to appear. Jaguar, owned by Ford, is also developing an engine with Orbital, but a 3.2-litre V6, suitable for a luxury car. Two-stroke engines have been used in cars before. The first was the DKW, which appeared in 1928, a three-cylinder, 500cc two-stroke. Others have been the much-maligned East German Trabant and Wartburg. The most successful was the Saab of the 1960s, given international fame as a rally car by Erik Karlsson. More recently, small-capacity two-strokes, tiny 360cc units, have been used by Daihatsu, Mazda, Mitsubishi and Suzuki in micro-cars sold only in Japan. Two-strokes were abandoned by manufacturers such as Saab and not adopted by others because their disadvantages were excessive oil consumption, sooty smoke and poor fuel economy. Those drawbacks have now been cured in the Ford Orbital engine by means of fuel injection into the cylinders, the principal breakthrough in the engine's design. Sue Baker, writing in The Observer.
Now some more of your letters. Dear friends, my name is Alexei Galevsky. At first I want to write about myself. I'm 19, second year course student of the technical school. As you understand from my address, I live in Ukraine, ex-Soviet Republic, on the southeast near Azov Sea. My second hobby is hunting, this winter time especially many foxes, hares and others. Now, here is the difficult time, especially in the economy. May you know that from January 92 there are two monies, ex-Soviet rubles and Ukrainian coupon karbarevnets. For rubles, I can pay only tickets and service only. All others, I can pay only for the coupons. Real Ukrainian currency will be in June of this year, which publishing now in Canada. But prices is very higher. 1 month getting 400 coupons, every people and others in rubles. But only one kilogram of meat costs 80 to 100 coupons. That's getting on for a week's wages for a kilogram of meat, he writes. Bread is 2 coupons, butter is 22 coupons, milk 6 to 8 coupons, bologna 25 to 120 coupons. And that's for a kilogram. A TV set costs 10 to 18,000 coupons. An audio recorder around 4 to 15,000 coupons, and a video recorder 35 to 40,000 rubles. Yes. As you see, the price is very much higher. Especially difficult to live it now in the cities, because all must pay in the shops. In the countryside, there are of course own meat and others. Every family has a good housekeeping. Thank you very much for your programmes. I'm very interested in exotic radio stations. We've sent him more information about Radiofax, and he says, I wish you all the best. Sorry for the mistakes. Well, that's understandable. Alexei Galevsky in Timoshevo in Ukraine. And, well, might not condone hunting over here, but if you can't afford to buy any food to eat, I think that's a bit more understandable, isn't it? And he reports listening with an R311 communication receiver with a 30-metre long wire aerial, and he picked us up on 12255. Thanks very much for that report and fascinating letter, Alexei. And someone from this country, a familiar face, George Williams, waiting for the reply to his letter to the Department of National Heritage, the Ministry of Fun, as it's otherwise known. I couldn't be more helpful, but it isn't an outright right refusal, writes George. Anything is better than the rubbish we've been hearing, boring speech radio from the BBC. Cornwall and that tedious pirate FM using Radio 1 type jingles and smart-ass presenters with computer gizmology. They can't even play a record request. What a rotten setup that is. I would rather have Caroline. I hope she gets a chance to go offshore again. There's no competition for her to worry about. After all, the easy money licenses being wasted on local rubbishy output. Did you hear about the chap who went to the doctor about wind? The doctor gave him a kite. Yes, not sure quite what that's got to do with Radio Caroline, but anyway, maybe I've missed something there. So, here's George's reply. He wrote asking, why can't Radiofax have a license to go on shortwave? Dear Mr. Williams, thank you for your letter of the 8th of June about a license for Radiofax. Licensing decisions are, of course, for the Radio Authority rather than this department, but there's no reason in principle why Radiofax should not apply for a national or local license when advertised by the Radio Authority. I understand, however, that Radiofax wishes to broadcast on shortwave. At present, the Radio Authority does not have access to any shortwave frequencies, which are used in this country for the BBC World Service. Their proposal raises a number of complex issues which are being considered, which go well beyond the responsibilities of this department, and it's therefore unlikely that Radiofax could be licensed in the short term. That's from R.L. Macy, the Broadcasting Policy Division. And if you want to write to the Department of National Heritage, the address is 50 Queen Anne's Gate, London, SW1H9AT. Department of National Heritage, 50 Queen Anne's Gate, London, Southwest 1H9AT. And letters here to Radiofax are much appreciated. And the address is Sparks, Radiofax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. And anything you write to us, well, you'll get a mention, you'll get some things read out on air. And if you'd like a reply, then please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1. So the address again is Sparks, Radiofax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6, 7BG. George Williams also sends a letter he received from Radio Harmony, just saying thank you for the reception report. But interesting for me is it's signed by Paul Graham, who's an old friend who I'll have to give a ring up because I didn't know he was involved with Radio Harmony. He was my contact for Radio Caroline. Much indebted to him. And Stephen DePanzer writes from Great Yarmouth in Norfolk. I'm enjoying the programmes of Radio Facts. I listen on 6205 kHz, although the signal fades at times. I've recently worked in Dewsbury, West Yorkshire, where your signal is much better, and I can listen almost any time on 6205. I'm now returning to Great Yarmouth, the above address, and would be grateful for any tips on improving reception. Well, if you've got a portable radio, try putting it on a radiator or something generally metallic, or laying out a sheet of tinfoil. That acts as a better earth and works against the internal aerial and generally helps it work better and can work better than a great big long wire which can just overload the input stage of the radio. But you can try a long wire twisted around the telescopic aerial or plugged in if you've got an aerial socket. He says, I listen on a Grundig 6000 with a telescopic aerial. Have you considered a channel on Astra to give FM quality, or possibly just leasing a few hours from another broadcaster, as this would bring you many more listeners? Well, I think that's debatable, and we think about it, yes, but how do we pay for it? That's another question. Well, thanks very much for writing in, Stephen DePanzer. And Michelle Goodman is in Newton Mearns in Glasgow. I've just discovered Radio Facts on shortwave. Could you please send me some more information? Done. Thanks, Michelle. And Dave Preston has contacted us from Leicester. He's blind and listens on the free radio supplied by the RNIB. Another sort of free radio. It's made by Roberts, has analogue tuning and covers the 49 to 25 metre bands on shortwave. He enjoys Sparks, the Radio Caroline programmes and all the others, although he's not so keen on country and western. Hopes we keep going well. Thanks for contacting us, Dave Preston from Leicester.
Completely untouchable. Ooh. I knew no surprises. Ooh. Wrapped in a cold world. Ooh. Of my own devising. But I heard you smashing and swinging hard outside. Ooh. Ooh. Saw your sweet face and I nearly died. I nearly died. Violently, you came to me, said I could be a different man, a different man. Violently, your words hit me, and I broke gently into your hand. Survivor, ooh. All brittle and hateful, ooh. I'm uncomprehending, ooh. Who would want this fool? But you chipped away until some poor soul appeared, ooh. Ooh. Shiver and tremble and stumbling around, then you brought me near. You and I broke gently into your hands, into your hands, into your hands. Oh, violently, violently. And now I broke into your hands.
This week on Sparks, Toshiba pull out of making audio equipment. We examine why. Problems with radon gas. What is it and how to get rid of it? 25 years of ITN. A new design of two-stroke engine for cars. The latest line of loony loudspeakers. Next, the success of arts graduates who join BBC Engineering for technical training. Lots more in the programme, as well as Radio Caroline news and your letters. That's Sparks this week.
Sarah Brooks, who took a degree in English, has ended up working as a qualified engineer for the BBC. How I engineered a change of direction. Sarah Brooks read English at London University, specialising in medieval literature. She graduated in 1988 and took a year off as a mother's help before joining the BBC as a trainee engineer. My family was keen for me to do engineering, but I thought I'd have to work very hard, and I didn't think I'd enjoy it, she says. I knew I enjoyed English, which came easily to me. Halfway through studying English, I decided I'd made a mistake and should have studied engineering, but I carried on. I was in the Netherlands looking after three kids when my mother used to ring me every week and say, "Why haven't you got a proper job?" Then she sent me a BBC advert saying, "If you have an arts degree, we will retrain you to be an engineer." I applied and passed the preliminary stage and a two-day assessment at the BBC's Engineering Training Centre at Wood Norton, Norfolk. Some mistake there, because it's actually near Evesham. After 2 weeks familiarisation in the news department, I started the A training course, very intensive and well taught, bringing you halfway to engineering degree standard in 16 weeks, followed by the A television course, which was specific to the job. Then there were the training placements, mending monitors and broadcast video machines in maintenance, to Westminster on parliamentary broadcasts, followed by 2 months in Broadcasting House. A year after completing the A course, we started the 12-week B course. This brought you virtually to degree standard. Next, I had 2 months in the Spur Central Apparatus Room, a huge communications centre where every vision and radio feed and every picture for news comes in. Then I worked on the teams, engineers who support the news programmes, line up cameras, mend equipment, make sure the huge newsroom computer used by journalists is working. Then it was back to Wood Norton for the C course, then the final 2 week specialist qualifying module and assessed project. This gave us what the BBC calls engineering qualified status, which is recognised within the broadcasting industry. We have to be at the same standard as the engineers who come in with degrees. We do the same work and are considered equal. Doing English first has been a positive advantage in my work. At the moment, I'm in the training section, writing material for the department. That was from an article in The Independent.
Infested heavens, waiting.
Here's a look at audio power amplifiers. Before outlining my tips for selecting the right amplifier for monitoring, let me bring you up to date. In the mid-1970s, a well-known UK amplifier maker proclaimed that all amplifiers should sound the same, provided they met certain basic specifications and were used within their ratings. The straight wire with gain sounded logical and reassuring. We believed him. 16 years later, we know with considerable certainty that many amplifiers sound quite different from one another when reproducing music, and that every amplifier works better with some speakers than others. Why should this be so? Out of all the electronics in the studio signal path, the power amplifier is the least realistically specified. To understand why, it helps to see how their mode of operation is at odds with the rest of the electronics in the chain. Mixers, tape machines, and sound effects units all operate nearly entirely in Class A. So the semiconductors work at a steady temperature, while signal currents are measured in milliamps at most. Power amplifiers not only operate almost exclusively in Class AB, so internal currents and component temperatures swing with the signal, they also draw and output vastly higher currents. With a number of competing, hostile AC, DC and output high current waveforms packed into a small box, and peak currents generally measured in tens of amperes, side effects, like electromagnetic breakthrough, that are below the noise in mixers and other line-level gear, are bound to be more ugly and more prominent, enough to alter what is heard. From this, we can deduce that design and layout finesse counts far more in power amplifier design than at line levels. The majority of audio electronics is still tested and specified according to its behaviour when passing steady sine waves. While noise and bandwidth plots are wholly useful, it can't be overstated that conventional total harmonic distortion plus noise and intermod distortion measurements are unrevealing and meaningless beyond a point. Most semiconductor equipment has long exceeded this point, generally along the lines of below 0.1% THD at all operating levels and audio frequencies. Until recently, nothing more sensitive and revealing was universally available to replace these tests. Meanwhile, in the past decade, loudspeaker performance has developed greatly in the wake of new measurement methods, notably Hayes's time delay spectrometry and the analysis of impulse response with software tools. These techniques reveal aspects of performance that aren't apparent with steady-state tests. Not before time, the design of amplifiers too is beginning to benefit from powerful measurement software, notably from DSP-based harmonic and intermod spectra plots, time domain analysis, and circuit simulation. Increasingly, with the benefit of minds broadened by experience, computers and new measurement tools, more and more detailed specifications are emerging. Combine these with psychoacoustic knowledge, and we begin to see why sonic differences are inevitable and how some may be controlled. Amplifiers are routinely tested and specified by driving into resistive loads, i.e. an 8-ohm resistor. This is convenient, but completely unrealistic. The average bass mid-cone speaker looks like a large capacitor, typically 200 microfarads, in parallel with a damped inductor. These values appear in series with the coil's DC resistance. A network of this kind looks benign when driven by continuous signals, but demands high currents when stimulated by music and speech transients. At low frequencies, the highest currents are often at adverse phase angles, so the output devices are asked to pass maximum current at the same time as they are sustaining high voltages. The result is an unexpectedly high dissipation. Amplifiers made with enough current capability to drive the most difficult loudspeakers are few and costly, and their focus would be wasted on the majority of less taxing speakers. The response of average, built-to-a-price MOSFET and tube amplifiers to a difficult loudspeaker load at high levels is generally some increased distortion and higher running temperatures. Bipolar output devices are less forgiving. They not only distort and run hot, but their survivability actually decreases with increasing dissipation. Most bipolar output stages are still fitted with voltage and current protection circuits, but in most users' experience, their life-saving effect is marginal, as they almost always degrade sound quality abruptly, as or even before they cut in. As professional users presumably treasure their equipment and can be trusted not to short the output cabling, there is much to be said for removing or defeating VI protection circuitry if you want to get the best from amplifiers with bipolar outputs. Interestingly, echoing what we did on the 12 meg transmitter modulator, by the way, there. The ability of an amplifier to reliably source enough current with or without adverse phase angles is just part of the story of its interaction with the speaker and the consequent sound of the combination. Damping factors that measure high in steady state tests may not be so good with real loads and music program. The quality and type of the loudspeaker cabling adds another tier of variables. Nearly all modern power amplifiers employ raw, unregulated power supplies. Quad's 23-year-old 303 design is one of a few exceptions. By contrast, all line-level electronics are powered from regulated supplies, which are able to filter out mains-borne noise and ripple frequency harmonics to a high degree. When allowing for highly variable output currents, with the possibility of peaks of tens of amperes, the unregulated supply is cheaper, but much less clean. It is only one step removed from the speakers, and one is left to rely on the amplifier's power supply rejection to remove hum harmonics. The majority of transistor amplifiers employ large amounts of negative feedback, which can provide correspondingly generous amounts of rejection of low frequencies. But inevitably, this falls off at higher frequencies, where ripple harmonics are most distressing to the ear. Moreover, the power supply can only replenish the energy drawn off the supply once every 10 milliseconds. If a kick drum thwack drains the supply reservoir, the average, economically specified power supply may not be able to fully replenish the supply for tens of cycles, and the recovery time, taking several hundred milliseconds, can be audible. The touring sound business has encouraged the development of compact, lightweight amplifiers using switching power supplies, which replenish the DC supply typically at 100 kHz, i.e. 100,000 times each second. The switching supply is also inherently regulated. Overall, amplifiers of this type are better able to reject mains noise, sags and surges, and their charging rate doesn't interact with audio frequencies or envelopes. There is inevitably a small HF residue on the output, but they invariably sound better than identical amplifiers mated to conventional raw supplies. Many users are used to classifying power amplifiers merely by their output devices, which are, in historic order, valves, bipolar junction transistors, or MOSFETs. Valve amplifiers are still used in some circles because they are held to sound good in spite of poor steady-state specifications. Both kinds of transistor amplifiers generally have better specifications and can yield high powers economically. In recent years, a myth has developed in which bipolar amplifiers are held to give a more satisfying bass quality, while MOSFETs are more likely to be appreciated for their top. Such generalizations are dangerous, yet understandable, when so many amplifiers share circuitry cribbed from a manufacturer's rather mundane recommended circuit. But depending on the designer's sympathies and knowledge, anything is possible, and MOSFETs can certainly hold their own in the bass. Prejudging an amplifier's suitability purely on the kind of output devices under the covers is an indication that a little knowledge is dangerous. Would you make a judgment on a new car's performance based on the kind of metal its pistons were made from? That's Ben Duncan in Lineup, the Journal of the Institute of Broadcast Sound.
In world broadcast news, Carlton Cable Time has developed an interactive game system for cable subscribers in association with top TV game show producers Action Time, based in Manchester in northern England. The two stablemates of Carlton Television, which is due to replace Thames TV in the London weekday Channel 3 franchise area next January, uses a switched star network with inherently high security, allowing high-value value prizes to be offered. The system allows quiz-based game answers to be downloaded to the local street switch, which then delivers an immediate response to entries. Games are played with the normal cable TV handset and require no extra equipment in the home. Storing answers locally eradicates the risk of delays caused by reference to a possibly remote cable headend, resulting in a faster game. It'll be interesting to see some of that in action. And a letter from Peter Grenfell, who's in Western Omaro, New Zealand. And looking through, he's got lots of reception reports. And he listens on a Kenwood R5000 with a 90-metre dipole. He's been DXing for 41 years. He's now retired from the estate and trust accounting work. And him and his wife Jill go square dancing once a week. He has two boys at university and a daughter engaged to be married. He's listening on 12255. Thanks very much for the letter, he says. I do hope at this late stage you're able to verify this report. Best wishes to all at Radio Facts. Sincerely, Peter Grenfell from Omaru in New Zealand. Thanks very much for that. And Jürgen Blum is in Düsseldorf in Germany. I had the great pleasure to listen to your station while staying on shortwave bands. I decided to send you a reception report. He's listening on 12255 and he's got a Yaesu FRG88000 in connection with a 22 meter long wire hanging up to 9 meter above the ground. And he says, well, it was a very nice program which today I listened to. I also checked the other frequencies used in parallel, and 12255 is the best signal here. 3910 is heard with poor signal strength, and 6205 is also a bit interfered. I very often listen to Radio Facts during the last weeks, and I'm happy that you're broadcasting all the day. Hi. So I hope that the Irish PTT will have problems to find your location. It's also a welcome part of radio listening to listen to free radio stations with such a professional programme structure. At weekends, I can very often listen to free radio stations from the continent, mainly from Holland or Germany, but their programme is not as attractive as yours. So please keep on broadcasting and let's fight for free radio. We should keep a good free radio scene without any radio operators which are in QSO with other stations. Regular broadcasts and actual broadcasts are highly appreciated, not only by myself. So he pays the postage in advance. I enclose stamps from the UK. I also enclose stamps from the Republic of Ireland. I think these are useful for your postal fees budget. You're an Irish free radio station. By the way, Eire is a very nice country which I visited twice and hope to come back in the next years. I always stayed near Cork on the west coast, Kenmare and Killarney. Just a good place to relax, to drink hot whiskey or just a Paddy, Jameson or Bushmills. Thanks very much, Jürgen Blum. He says, thanks a lot for your patient. Kind regards from Düsseldorf.
I only wanna learn
Caroline, in its various shapes and forms, has been getting mentions in odd places. First, an event which did not take place on time as scheduled, mentioned here on Radio Netherlands Media Network.
And judging from this next caller from the UK, more sounds from Ireland are expected in the next couple of days.
This is Mike Barraclough in Letchwood. Radio Caroline have announced that they will commence broadcasts on Saturday at 0900 on 6305 kHz. Using a 1 kilowatt transmitter in Ireland. Transmissions were due to start last weekend, but the tapes were delayed in the post. The broadcasts will be weekends only, eventually for 32 hours.
I guess you have to call that a land-based offshore radio station.
And then, an advertisement spotted by Jodie, reading carefully through her Media Guardian. A small box advert. Radio Caroline requires... It continues, Radio Caroline requires experienced AOR format program controller for launch of their European-based satellite-delivered radio station. Send details in confidence to Linda Haywood, MMI, Radnor House, Suite 500, 83 Regent Street, London, W1R, 7TG. That advert there, costing several hundred pounds, appeared in Media Guardian. And while we're looking at unusual adverts, here's something about the record producer Joe Meek. He was one of the first people to mess about with several tape machines and do multi-tracking. You may have seen the interesting BBC Two documentary about him a year or so ago. In Private Eye, there's an advert about a museum, Stinking Rich Benefactor Required, for this exciting educational vintage recording equipment centre at the legendary producer's old studio, the Joe Meek Museum. And the telephone number, if you want to support the project, is 081 878 6912, as advertised in Private Eye. What looks like a pair of giant snails costs £10,000 and sounds out of this world? Answer, the latest in loudspeakers. It's feeding time in the living room. Hi-fi loudspeakers have rarely been things of beauty. Anyone who likes to listen to music at home has become accustomed to the ugly wooden boxes clad in cheap veneers that cast a blight over the living room. In their quest for the ultimate wedding of woofer and tweeter, engineers seem to have paid little attention to the appearance of the fruits of their labours. People really don't like seeing speakers. I know I'd rather look at a good painting than a piece of medium-density fibreboard any day, says Steve Moore of the Cornflake Shop, an unusually progressive hi-fi retailer in London. Customers often want them to be smaller, particularly if they have a flat or are pushed for space. One result of this problem has been a growing movement to hide speakers from view, either recessing them into the ceiling and walls or dividing huge bass units from the smaller treble speakers. The former can then be hidden, at least behind the sofa, while the satellite trebles can stand less conspicuously out in the open. Brinkman, a young company from South Wales, tried another approach. It decided to make a speaker that was attractive. For its form, the firm decided on a classical archetype, the Grecian urn, a slightly odd choice, as Keats's unravished bride of quietness was admired for its silence. The speaker was christened Endymion, because in Greek mythology the god is supposed to have fathered 50 daughters, and Brinkman is keen to expand in a similar fashion. One of the two designers of Endymion was Richard Thomas Davis. "They've been an amazing success," he says. "We won an award of excellence at the Ideal Home Exhibition and have sold 500 pairs since March. Apparently, a similar sort of urn filled with water was used to test the tone of Russian Orthodox churches. The Endymion is made from a ceramic material rather than wood because it does not resonate or flex, vital to good acoustic performance. It also offers 360-degree sound, which means you can move around while listening to music. They cost £395 a pair. The hi-fi industry can be very remote from actual music," says Mr. Thomas Davis. "There is a growing movement away from super sophisticated electronics. My brother works on the mainframe computer at the European Space Agency, but he can't even operate his video recorder. Another manufacturer on the omnidirectional track, although still happy to keep things super sophisticated, is MBL in Berlin. In its quest for the ultimate speaker, MBL even engaged the services of a pair of professors from the Aerospace Department of Berlin University. The result is the 101 model, or the Teutonic Tangerine, as it has become known in the trade. If you are fortunate enough to have £5,800 to spend on a pair of hi-fi speakers, the 101 could be for you. It is a lot of money," admits Wolfgang Mielecki of MBL. "But reproducing the sound of a classical quartet, where the instruments cost maybe £500,000, cannot be done cheaply. Purchasers of the 101 can be reassured that they will be members of an exclusive group. Production is steady at 2 pairs each week."
Well, unfortunately, we've got to relieve that report there because we're running out of time. You can hear the rest of it next week. You're listening to Sparks on Radio Facts. Stay tuned.